MacCast, Sunday, March 18th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to another week in the world of Apple and Macs and iOS devices and all the other things. How are you doing? I hope you are doing well. I've had a pretty good week and a nice weekend, and we're getting ready to start the next one. So hopefully this kicks off your week whenever you might be listening to it. But we have quite a few things to talk about. We're going to be getting into some of the next announcements that we expect coming from Apple. So kind of almost a roundup of all the latest rumors and possible release dates and things like that. We're going to talk about Apple acquiring a new company, something they talked about at South by Southwest, and what that might mean for Apple news and more of Apple's content. Little updates to Apple's Made for iPhone program, their MFI program, and then also what's happening with the iPhone upgrade cycle. We'll get into all of that, and then we've got some follow-up from the last few episodes to talk to you about. Many of you wrote in with your comments and thoughts on some of the things that we've been discussing. We're going to get into parental controls, talk about that a little bit, and as it relates to another announcement Apple actually made this week, or an update they put on their website to be more accurate. And we're going to talk about markup and why you might not want to use that for privacy reasons. I'll explain what that means a little later in the show, and we'll round things out talking about the different sleep modes that are on your Mac, because I had a question about that this week. So it should be a great show, maybe a little bit shorter one. We don't have a ton of news this week, so let's just jump right into that news, starting off with some of Apple's next expected announcements. This week, DigiTimes had a little bit different report than we had been hearing from analysts like Ming-Chi Kuo about what Apple might be planning for its next MacBook Air update. DigiTimes mentioned a 13.3-inch, what they're calling entry-level MacBook update that they're expecting Apple to release soon. The report is a little bit confusing because they also say that the new model will be priced the same, if not slightly higher, than the current generation MacBook Air. So they call it a MacBook, but then they talk about MacBook Air pricing, and the display size, 13.3 inches, is squarely inside the MacBook Pro arena and also the MacBook Air arena, not MacBook. They say it's going to have a Retina display at the same resolution as the 13.3 inch MacBook Pro, and also that there would be a slightly higher priced version at $1,199. The difference being is that would come with 256 gigabytes of storage versus 128. So they seem to be mixing the two up, or maybe these two things are exactly the same rumor. We had heard from Ming-Chi Kuo that Apple was planning to release pretty soon a lower priced MacBook Air. And we may have a little hint later in the show as to when and why they might be doing that. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. So that seems to be the latest on what's going on with a possible MacBook Air update. DigiTimes also said that Apple is planning an entry-level iPad update sometime in the second quarter. That's the one that we're expecting them to do some sort of price drop towards the back half of the second quarter. That iPad might start as low as $259, so it could be just a price drop. There could be a small spec update. Currently, Apple sells the entry-level 9.7-inch iPad at $329, so that would be a significant price drop. And again, there may be a good reason for that, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. Speaking of iPads, Taiwan Economic Daily News is saying that Apple is actually planning to release a new iPad Pro. And we've heard this from some other sources, and we've been talking about it on the MacCast recently. But the report from Economic Daily News is a little bit different. They claim the updated model could have an 11-inch display. So not just an update to the 11.5-inch, they'd actually increase the display size a little bit, but keep it exactly the same form factor, because it's expected, as we've talked about, that they're going to ditch the home button and it will have thinner bezels. The same report also mentions an update to the 12.9-inch model, but they don't talk about a larger size display on that one. And for both announcements, they say they expect it to happen around or at Worldwide Developer Conference, which this week Apple also opened up the registrations for. So we now know that that event is going to be held June 4th through the 8th in San Jose. So mark your calendars on that one. As far as some other specs for updated iPad Pros, they mention things that track pretty much with the other rumors that we've been hearing: an updated A11X Bionic chip processor, 8-core version of that, the true depth camera system, and Face ID unlocking. Of course, if they're going to get rid of the home button, they're going to need that. The one area that is being heavily debated, though, is there going to be a notch or not a notch in an iPad Pro update with Face ID? And I don't know which way I'm leaning. I kind of feel like Apple's going to stick with the notch, because that's now kind of an iconic design thing. Like it or not, it does distinguish Apple's devices. Many are saying, though, with an iPad, they could just make the bezel slightly larger and fit the sensors in there and not have to notch out the display, which maybe on a larger screen device would be a lot nicer, especially if they have that kind of extra real estate. So we're going to have to wait and see what Apple does, but I fully expect that the next versions of the iPad Pro certainly are going to have the TrueDepth camera system. They also said that they don't see an iPhone update happening in the first half of 2018, which would contradict some other rumors we'd been hearing about a possible iPhone SE 2 update, a new version of the iPhone SE, although the lack of an update is something that Ming-Chi Kuo also had mentioned. So it's not looking like, at least in the first half of the year, we're going to get any kind of iPhone SE update. That doesn't mean we might not see one in the fall, but for now, probably not going to happen. Even though Mac Takara posted a very sketchy video out of China that claimed to be a updated version of the iPhone SE and iPhone SE 2. It essentially showed the current design merged with what looked like to be an iPhone 10. So I don't know if there was some clever Photoshopping going on there or what was happening. It was an actual demo, so it's probably some cheap Chinese knockoff thing, because they flipped it over around the back. It kind of had the square edges, but it also had a little bit of the iPhone 10 curved edge display. Like I said, it looked like the two products somewhat merged together. And then around the back, it did have a dual lens camera bump. So immediately that screamed to me, fake. Although the real seal on the deal as to it being fake was the fact that it did show no home button and a true depth camera system. And I think there's no way that's coming to an iPhone SE model, not at the price point that it's at. So if you did see that video, that's not an iPhone SE 2, although it is kind of fun to think about. I guess it's interesting, but not something that Apple is going to do. Also in iPhone news, over in India, Apple's supplier Wistron has received approval to build a new $150 million assembly plant. Wistron is currently the manufacturer of the iPhone in India, so that Apple can sell iPhones into the India market and also have retail stores there. They are reportedly looking to expand the factory to help with that production, also to do Internet of Things stuff, and possibly because they're looking to expand their Apple business also into manufacturing and assembling the iPhone 6S models, which are also selling in that region and would sell very well. So looking to do that. They did get in a little bit of trouble with Apple, though, allegedly, according to the Commercial Times. They say that Wistron was caught using, quote, unauthorized components in the production of the iPhone 8 Plus in China. They were supposedly using fake waterproofing components, something that, of course, Apple is going to frown on. The report claimed that when Apple found out, they forced the company to halt production for up to 2 weeks while things got resolved. For their part, Wistron didn't comment directly, but in a Taiwan Stock Exchange filing, they did say that they wouldn't comment on matters concerning specific clients and that there was not a two-week production suspension. So it wasn't a flat-out denial. It could have been a shorter suspension or no suspension at all. It's really not clear at this point. There were other reports that say Wistron penalized several mid to high-level executives at the company as a way of showing Apple that they took the situation very seriously. And it doesn't appear, or we haven't heard any reports of Apple firing Wistron, so sounds like they worked things out. But man, if that was going on, that's not something you want to hear as an iPhone owner, that you could possibly have, you know, non-authorized, cheaper waterproofing components inside your iPhone 8 Plus. I would imagine if it was rampant or something big happened, Apple would be doing a recall, and we haven't heard that occurring either. So interesting story, but Wistron seems to be expanding their Apple business despite the little controversy. In the Apple or iPhone accessories area, we are hearing a little bit more of Apple's wireless charging Air Power mat. This is the mat that they showed off at their last event for iPhone. They said it was coming sometime in 2018, and it is going to give you the ability to charge up to three devices wirelessly on the same pad, an iPhone 10 or an iPhone 8, 8 Plus, your Apple Watch Series 3, and if you get the new $69 Air Pods wireless charging case, which isn't out yet either, you'll be able to charge your AirPods on the same mat. So all three at once. DigiTimes claims that that device might be available for sale soon. They're saying by the end of March. And they claim that it's going to have a maximum charging performance of 29 watts. So I'm guessing that's for the total of all three devices, about just under 10 watts per device. Now, Apple's new iPhones charge at a maximum charging rate of 7.5, so this would seem to indicate that they could do a little bit more. I don't know if that's maybe a sign of things to come with a future update, that maybe we'll have even faster charging when the new iPhones arrive this fall, about 10 watts per section. So we'll have to see. We've been hearing a few rumors about what the price of the AirPower mat is going to be. Apple hasn't officially claimed anything, but I've heard prices as high as $179, maybe even $199 for that charging mat, which seems crazy to me. I figured Apple might sell it for around $100, maybe $99, and I don't even know if they could get away with that. And as I say that, in reality, I know that many Apple fans will pay almost anything for an Apple-branded product. And it certainly is cool. It has a lot of convenience built into it. But when you consider the fact that you can get a compatible wireless Qi charger for around $20, if you want to go with a faster charging one, maybe $25-$30, that's going to be a hard sell, I think, for a lot of people. I don't think I'm going to be picking up an AirPower mat. And if you add into the fact that if you want to charge your AirPods, you're going to have to buy another $69 case. You're looking at, you're getting pretty close to the cost of a new HomePod just to have wireless charging with an Apple-branded logo on it. So I don't know, that's interesting. I'd be curious to know, are you excited about the AirPower mat? If it's that price, what do you think the right price point should be? Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, that thing I was teasing you about, we did hear this week about an Apple event that's going to be happening in just about a little over a week. Apple sent out press invites to an event at Lane Tech College Prep High School in Chicago. It's going to be happening on Tuesday, March 27th. The invites said, let's take a field trip. So it's looking like it's going to be an educational-focused event. It seems like the right place to me for Apple to announce that lower priced iPad we've been talking about, and also maybe those lower priced updated MacBook Airs. Those would be definitely targeted at the education arena. And Apple also will likely discuss some of their other education products like Classroom. And something that I think many people would like them to discuss, and something that they, you know, may or may not do, is some sort of Apple services that would be targeted at the education environment. Right now, education environments can take advantage of things like iTunes and iCloud, but the students need to have iTunes accounts, or that stuff needs to be managed through IT, and it's all iCloud.com. Education institutions don't have the ability to use their own domains, and it sort of makes management a little bit difficult. It would also be nice, I think, to see Apple opening up iCloud storage and services for either a reduced cost or maybe even free to the education market. I think it would go a long way into Apple maybe working their way back into that environment. I think they've really been losing ground recently to services like Google, which offers free email and other services for Google Docs and those sorts of things to schools. And I know that's what my kids' school uses, and a lot of other schools around the country are going that route. And a big advantage there is they do get to use their own school domains for email accounts. And if Apple could open up something like that with iCloud email accounts or storage, again, specifically targeted at education, I think that would be a really cool thing to see them do. This isn't anything we've heard about in the rumors, but it's something that's been discussed about in the community, especially among education people who are Apple fans for a while now. So we'll have to wait and see. We'll find out on Tuesday, March 27th, what Apple has to tell us about education. But that's sort of the latest on what Apple might be doing over the next couple months, at least in terms of product announcements and events. Another big deal happened this week between Apple and a company called Texture. They make an app for the iPhone that lets you access, well, I guess iPhone and iPad, that lets you access over 200 digital magazines for a monthly subscription charge. They charge $10 a month, and you get access to digital versions of a bunch of very popular publications. Well, this week at South by Southwest in Austin, Eddie Q announced that Apple has a deal pending to actually acquire Texture. He also did confirm that Apple plans to integrate Texture into Apple News. And I wonder, because they didn't go into any details, how that possibly would be rolled out. Would it be simply an add-on as a premium service? Is it something they're planning on rolling in and offering free of charge? Q did point out in the interview that Apple News is unique because it doesn't have an advertising focus, but I would imagine they have to make money from that service in some way or another. Right now, I believe that individual publications that publish into Apple News can sell and put ads in their content, although, to be honest with you, when I use Apple News, I do not see ads as I'm browsing around, at least in most of the content. So part of this focus seems to be on having curated sort of news and information from trusted sources, and Apple trying to expand things there. And that was another part of this deal that Eddie Q did talk about at South by Southwest. He also mentioned a few numbers. He said that Apple News users about a year ago followed about 4 publications on Apple News, and now on average that's up to 20. It's interesting because I like Apple News when I go in and use it, but I have to be honest with you, I don't use it on a daily basis. And I don't know if that's simply because I'm addicted to RSS feeds and that's where I get most of my news, or if it's just not the kind of product for me. I went in there as I was prepping this story and thought, wow, there's a lot of really good content in here. I probably should be checking it out. And I do like the fact that it sort of summarizes things and puts things into areas of interest that I've defined when I set up the app. You know, a lot of my news is technology and entertainment focused because that's the sort of stuff that I'm into. And they do seem to do a pretty good job at curating that stuff. I wish it was a little bit deeper, and maybe that is another part of what this Texture acquisition is all about. And so this seems like exciting news to me. It'll be interesting to see and follow along with what Apple does with the content once they have it in-house. Again, the deal is not done, I don't think, but certainly it looks like it's going to happen, especially if Apple is talking about it publicly. Another area where Apple is looking at expanding content, of course, is in their original programming, and Eddie Q did talk about what Apple is doing on that front as well, which was interesting, something you typically don't see Apple doing, kind of opening up about stuff that's maybe coming in the future. He didn't go into a lot of details, like talking about how the service was going to be rolling out, something that I am curious to know about, but he did talk about the kinds of content that Apple is trying to go after and the strategy that they're taking. He says that Apple cares about great storytelling, acquiring top talent and talented newcomers when it comes to producing their own original media. Now, he was talking specifically about the kinds of shows they were looking to produce, but I would say that Apple is taking a similar approach in their focus to building up the team that is going to hire the top talent and pick those great stories and decide what programming is going to be in there. If you've been following along, they now have an original content team that has grown to over 40 people over the course of the last year. So they've been investing also in the infrastructure, I think, to produce some really great content. And I don't know about you, but I'm getting pretty excited the more I hear about the kinds of shows that Apple is doing and the kinds of focus they're putting on it. And this week was no exception with him talking about great storytelling. I hope they can pull it off. Some of their early efforts have been less than awesome, I guess I would say. You know, certainly well-produced content in terms of both Carpool Karaoke and Planet of the Apps, but not overall interesting or engaging, I think, at least not to a broader audience. I think they have their niches, but, you know, they're not home runs by any stretch of the imagination. But it does feel like, with everything we're hearing surrounding their upcoming efforts, that they're on track to produce some really good stuff. They say they want to stay focused on quality, not quantity, and they seem to be taking those steps. And Eddie Q also did say they're not looking to take on Netflix or Disney. They're not looking for an acquisition or purchase of those companies. That's something that's been batted around in the community and by analysts and things like that. They really want to focus on doing their own thing, and that's sort of in the Apple tradition of how they approach things. Finally, he did say there was going to be a, quote, surprise bit of technology in their service when it rolls out. Of course, he didn't give any details as to what that might be, but it does kind of get you wanting to speculate a little bit. And you remember way back when that Steve Jobs had said in an interview at one point that they had, quote, unquote, cracked television. So I'm a little bit curious when I heard this if it's somewhat related to whatever that might be. But they're certainly expanding those original content programs. And in fact, yes, you know, like we've talked about, every week we're going to get some sort of new announcement. This week was no exception. Apple has reportedly ordered a new comedy animated series from Lauren Bouchard, the creator of Fox's Bob's Burgers, which is a extremely popular program. I have a lot of friends who are very into that. I haven't watched it myself because I don't have cable. It's not, as far as I know, on any of my streaming services. I may have to look into that. But this week, according to Variety, Apple has ordered up a new show from those creators. They've ordered 2 seasons, 13 episodes each, of a show that's going to be called Central Park. It's written by Bouchard and Josh Gad and Nora Smith, and they are going to be telling the story of a family of caretakers who live and work in Central Park and end up saving the park and basically the world. So I'm interested to know how all that pans out. It's also going to have Gad and some very talented other folks doing voice work on the show. Big name talent like Kristen Bell and Stanley Tucci. So again, Apple investing in some pretty big name talent for their new programs. And I'm excited to see what they do. As a matter of fact, just as a summary for you, because Apple's list of shows continues to grow each week, I figured we probably should do a short recap. So there's that new animated show I just mentioned. Also a psychological thriller series produced by M. Night Shyamalan. There's going to be a new drama series called Swagger, which is based on the youth of Golden State Warriors player Kevin Durant. A drama series from Damien Chazelle, the writer and director of the musical La La Land. A 10-episode comedy series starring Kristen Wiig. A drama series about the morning talk show industry starring Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. a sci-fi drama series from Ronald D. Moore. He's the developer of the Battlestar Galactica series. Also, the reboot of Steven Spielberg's 80s anthology, The Amazing Stories. That's probably the show I'm most excited about, being a child of the 80s. There's going to be a world-building drama set in the future from the creators of Peaky Blinders. Also, a series based on the novel Are You Sleeping, starring Octavia Spencer, and then a 10-episode reality series called Home that is going to show off extraordinary homes from around the world and talk to the people who built them. And as far as I know, that is all the original content programming that Apple is working on, but that's like, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I think 11 shows in total, and I am really excited to see many of these series. A lot of them sound like they're going to be very compelling and very cool, and I'm just, again, very curious to see how Apple rolls all of this stuff out. I imagine and hope that it's going to be some sort of expansion to Apple Music, whether it's free or a small upcharge. You know, I'd gladly pay maybe $5-$10 a month more on my Apple Music subscription to get access to some of this content. And I have a feeling, just my gut tells me, that's how Apple might roll it out. And finally, one other bit of information that Eddie Q let out at the South by Southwest interview was that Apple Music is growing very quickly. It has been growing quickly, continues to grow very quickly. They gained 2 million subscribers in just about the past 5 weeks. The total number of paid subscribers Apple Music now has is at about 38 million. And he did say that about 8 million people are signed up for the free trial. So Apple may add even more subscribers very soon. And they, you know, their services business, we've been talking about this, is now the second largest portion of their business behind iPhone. And certainly Apple Music is making up a big part of that. And any efforts they would do in the original programming content space is only going to expand those numbers and grow that part of Apple's business. So I'm excited to see what they roll out. I'd be curious to know, you know, is this something that you think is good for Apple? Is it something that's ultimately bad? I do worry that maybe they're getting stretched a little bit too thin and there's certain parts of the business that are not receiving the attention that they should. But I think as far as the original content taking away from that, I don't think that's what's going on here, because again, they've hired an entire separate team. They're kind of set up separately, and it's really almost a separate division, almost a separate company. So I don't think it's just detracting, you know, iPhone developers from, or iOS developers from, you know, making the next version of iOS. But I'd love to know your opinion. Shoot me some email, maccast@gmail.com. Apple updated their Made for iPhone program, and for those of you who don't know, that's the thing that certifies accessories as working with your Apple devices. And the reason this is significant this week is because they did open it up for some other kinds of technology that haven't been available in the program before. They're now going to allow accessory makers to include USB-C ports on their Made for iPhone charging accessories for both Mac and iOS. So that means that if you have, you know, Lightning devices and USB devices and USB-C devices, and you need to be able to charge both from a single charger, Apple's going to certify those accessories. So that's pretty cool. Those accessories will be allowed to work with the USB-C cables that come and ship with new Macs. And I believe that's a charge only cable, but that's another good thing, because I'm not sure that was allowed under the old MFI program. So that expansion. The updated rules also say that accessories with Lightning ports can now offer pass-through charging. But if it's one of those newer accessories that has both Lightning and USB-C, that's not going to be allowed to do pass-through charging or syncing of an iOS device. So there's a little bit of a restriction on that update. And then finally, makers of Made for iPhone accessories can now make Lightning to 3.5 millimeter output cables. And I was a little bit confused like this, because I thought, well, don't we already have dongles that will take my Lightning connector and allow me to plug in a 3.5 millimeter jack? Yes, we do, but this is the opposite cable. So the ability to plug into your Lightning cable or your Lightning connector, and then you have a 3.5 millimeter output jack that you can put into, say, like an auxiliary input either in your car or on a speaker product and go directly from your iPhone to that. So you're now going to be able to get that adapter where you couldn't in the past, at least not an official made for iPhone one. So some nice little updates to Apple's made for iPhone program that should bring us some new accessories for our Apple gear. And then finally in the news for this week, Gene Munster and Loop Ventures did a little bit of a survey to find out how many people are going to be upgrading their iPhones this year. They surveyed 511 people, and out of those, 226 were current iPhone owners, and of those, about 22% said that they expect to upgrade their iPhone this fall. And while the sample size is a little bit small, it does track with last year's numbers of iPhone upgraders. About 23% of current iPhone users upgraded to new devices. In the same survey, they said about 20% of the people in that survey expect to upgrade to an iPhone 8 or an iPhone 10 within the next year. And I found that number very interesting because it was almost the same size as the number that expect to upgrade to a new iPhone this year. So are people typically in the cycle world where they will wait almost 6 months, 7 months, 8 months after a new iPhone comes out before they upgrade? I thought we were kind of past that because we don't have the lock-in contracts with the carriers anymore. So maybe this is all about waiting until the new device comes out so you can get a better deal, or maybe you're looking for carrier deals that get better as you move longer into the cycle of a new iPhone. I was trying to wrap my brain around why there's still about 20% of the people out there who are considering upgrading to this year's model of the iPhone. I would think that would sort of trail off. That number felt a little bit high to me. But I think that's pretty cool. And it also shows that you can't just judge numbers of, you know, we've been talking a lot about many analysts saying, well, iPhone 10 sales have not gone as well as Apple has wanted and all this sort of stuff. Well, it sounds like there's still a lot of people who are waiting and thinking about upgrading to an iPhone 10. So I don't think that can be necessarily a bad thing. So interesting numbers there. But the overall conclusion of the study the survey done by Loop Ventures was that iPhone sales are going to continue to kind of fall into this predictable pattern of a between 1-5% annual growth rate. So again, kind of remaining pretty flat. And I don't find this surprising at all. I know some people are thinking, oh my gosh, iPhone sales, you know, they're not doing very well. Apple's not seeing the big growth that they used to see. Well, yeah, that's typical for a very mature product. The iPhone is now Apple's, you know, largest portion of their business. It is their cash cow. As long as they're maintaining that level, you know, 1-5% growth, I think that's pretty good. And they'll do that for a number of years. And then again, that will slowly start to trend down as it typically does for products in a product cycle as we move on to whatever the next thing is that's going to replace smartphones. You know, we're not there yet, but think 5-10 years out, maybe 15 years out from now, what are we going to have for our communication? Is it going to be some sort of heads-up display? Is it going to be something related to, you know, voice control things, augmented reality stuff? I don't know, but Apple is already exploring all of those technologies. We've talked about that. So they're already planning the next big thing. They have been planning it, I'm sure, for years now. So this is hardly a concern or a surprise to Apple. And just expect, you know, if you're looking at iPhone sales, that they're going to be relatively flat for the next few years. As long as we don't see sharp declines, Apple is going to be doing just fine. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Small Dog. Hey, if you haven't checked out Small Dog, head to smalldog.com. Small Dog Electronics, they've been a staple in the Apple and Mac community since 1995. They ship and sell Apple products. They started in their living room, Apple products and third-party products and accessories, stuff for your Macs and your Apples. And what's cool is they're not just a big conglomerate warehouse company. These are real people. They have real dogs. I love that they embrace the small dog name and the small dog focus. Go to their website. You can see the people and their dogs. And it's really, really cool. They offer great professional service, something you'd expect from a friend in the Mac community. And they really are, you know, members of our Mac community. They have a couple of locations, and their website is just amazing. They have an amazing selection, especially of new and refurbished Mac and Apple products and accessories. They have a full lineup. You want to go there every week. You want to check the website regularly because they're constantly getting in new refurbished stock, new items, and they're always updating the website. So make sure you go there. You can also follow their Facebook account. They'll post things there. And they have an ever-growing selection of products that you want to stay on top of. And one of the sections they've been really building out that I'm kind of excited about because I'm into it is home automation products. So they have all kinds of stuff that is HomeKit compatible from manufacturers like Philips, Elgato, Honeywell. So check out that section. And you can get some really, really great deals. And speaking of great deals, you get no sales tax on most orders and free shipping on orders over $75. And for orders made before 3 p.m. Eastern, you can sometimes get and often get same day shipping. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, they are giving you an extra added discount. You can use the code MacCast when you make your purchase at smalldog.com. Use the code MacCast and you're going to get $20 off an order of $100 or more. So you can't do much better than that. Check them out, smalldog.com, and a big thank you to Small Dog Electronics for their support of the MacCast. So as I said, we need to follow up on a few things that we've been talking about here on the show, starting off with our little conversation. We had somebody write in and ask, you know, is the iPad mature enough at this point to really be a replacement for a MacBook or a Mac? And I weighed in on my thoughts on that. I asked you to weigh in with your thoughts, and many of you tended to agree with kind of the statements I made on the MacCast, where at this point, I think it really depends. It has a lot to do with the application, but I think overall, certainly for many kinds of computer, quote unquote, computer users, an iPad is all you really need at this point. It's not for everyone. We still have a few exceptions, but it's growing and it's getting better and better, and especially with a product like the iPad Pro and a smart, you know, you throw a smart keyboard on there, and it really can, for many people, become a computer replacement. Speaking of those exceptions, though, Robert wrote in. He said, you know, I'm a photo pro. I'm a photographer. I have one area where the iPad Pro, just where a couple areas, actually, where the iPad Pro just doesn't work for me, and I actually need like a Mac or a MacBook. And the big area was the lack of external storage or the ability to directly support, you know, in a really good integrated way like you have with your MacBook. I got to caveat this because I'll always get people who write in and say, oh, well, you can do storage. You know, you can do external storage with an iPad, or you can use SD cards with an iPad, and you can. But let's be honest, all of the solutions are a little bit kludgy. They're a little bit clunky. They're not as convenient as what you would have with a MacBook or an iMac or something like that. So I tend to agree with Robert, and especially for things like photo editing or video editing, things where you're dealing with large files, you run out of storage on the iPad. The built-in storage isn't enough, and you need a way to offload that stuff. The cloud is okay, but again, it's kind of clunky. It can be slow if you don't have, you know, fast internet access, especially if you're working remotely. It's just not an overall solution. But I guess that brings me back to the other point, Robert, where, you know, I don't think that iPads are the right computers for those kinds of applications. They're certainly not the right computers for every kind of application, and I don't know that they ever should be. You know, it's the whole trucks analogy that Steve Jobs gave, where a lot of people can get around in cars, but every once in a while, or for certain kinds of tasks, you need a truck. And I think, you know, professional photography, high-end video editing, maybe even some programming applications at certain levels, those are things where you're just going to always probably need more of a quote-unquote traditional, and I don't even like using that word, you're going to need a desktop or a notebook or something like that. And I don't think that's changing anytime soon. And I don't think even an iPad Pro, you know, and Robert did point out the fact, you know, it does have that Pro moniker, but it's not for every Pro. And I think exactly, you know, that is exactly right. Not an iPad Pro isn't Pro for every kind of Pro out there, but there are a lot of kinds of Pros that can use it. And I'm thinking more about, I know digital artists who are using them. I know creative writers and you know, that term Pro user is a really broad term. And it's almost like we need to, you know, segregate that into different areas. Another area that Robert pointed out where the iPad falls a little short is in the ability to maybe run quote unquote full desktop style apps, specifically things like Photoshop. And yeah, we don't have Photoshop for the iPad, but we still have applications like Affinity Photo, which I've heard is absolutely amazing. So if you're looking for a photo editing app or a Photoshop-like app for the iPad, Affinity Photo is the one that I know most of my friends who are professional photographers are using with the iPad. And I've heard nothing but glowing reviews for it. I've never personally used it myself, but I just throw that out there. So certainly, you know, iPad and sort of the role of the iPad is changing. Another thing I mentioned on that last episode was that, you know, I really can't do a lot of my programming tasks. You know, I do web development and I've tried to do it on the iPad, but again, it's just not there in terms of the workflow being easy to use. You can make it work, but everything kind of feels a little bit like a kludge. And Michael wrote in to say, hey, I've been learning programming. I've been teaching myself Python, and I found this great app on the iPad called Pythonista, and it allows you to do, you know, IDE Python development on the iPad. So here's an example where you can do at least a degree of coding on the iPad. And Michael, I will say, yeah, I didn't mean in the last episode to sound like you can't, quote unquote, can't do programming on an iPad, because you certainly can. There's many ways to do it. I've actually used an app for PHP coding called Draft Code, and it has the ability to run a MySQL Lite database. It even has the ability to install like WordPress on your iPad, but it's still in kind of this sandboxed environment. It's somewhat limited, so you can use it and it works and you can do the programming there, but to do it at a real, you know, quote unquote pro level, or at the kind of level that you can with a desktop or a notebook, it's just not at the same place. It really isn't. I think it's good for learning. I think it's good for simpler projects, but it's not really practical for working on large web projects. Now, again, that's not to say you couldn't do that with an iPad, but you'd really have to flip around and think about the workflow. You could integrate apps like Prompt, you know, or any kind of terminal or SSH app. You could set things up on a web server to do all your hosting over there, and you could use apps like Transmit or FTP clients to move your files back and forth and sort of, you know, work off the server using your iPad almost as a terminal with some supplemental applications to maybe do some local programming and development and then sync things up. But you'd really have to kind of develop a new workflow that specifically, you know, is designed around the iPad and how it works. And I bet you there are some programmers out there that are doing that already. So again, I think that line is constantly moving, it's constantly growing, and the iPad is becoming more and more a viable daily driver for a lot of people. And I think it's absolutely amazing. And I think Steve Jobs' prediction and the thing that Tim Cook has talked about is that eventually, I think more people are going to be using things like iPads as their computers than they are using traditional desktops or notebooks. But once again, there's still going to be that segment where a notebook or a desktop is the right tool for the job, and you're going to have certain segments that will always just rely on those devices. And, you know, the iPad will never be the right computer for them. So You know, that's kind of what we were talking about, and that's where the conversation has gone to so far. If you have more thoughts and opinions on this, certainly share those with me. I would like to hear some audio comments from folks, so if you want to send in a quick 2-3 minute clip, shoot me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that we talked about on the last episode was ringtones and getting ringtones onto your iOS device. And I talked about a method where you could do it inside iTunes. But listener David emailed in to remind me that there's actually great ringtone functionality inside GarageBand. You can use GarageBand to create, edit, and publish ringtones to your iOS device. And I had kind of completely forgotten about that. To be honest, David, I thought it had been removed when they took the podcasting stuff out, but you corrected me, or you, as you pointed out to me, it's right there. If you open up the current version of GarageBand on your Mac, there is a ringtone project. You can select that. You can create and edit your ringtone in there. And once you have it all ready to go and you're satisfied with it, you just go up to the share menu. And under the share menu right there, there is a ringtone to iTunes sharing option. You send it over and then you can sync it right over to your device through the tones menu, or yeah, through the tones section on your device, like we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, sync it up with the Lightning USB cable, and there you go. You have a ringtone on your iOS device, a custom ringtone. So thanks for reminding me about that, David. That was great. This week, Apple updated their website. They actually set up a brand new families section at apple.com/families, where they kind of highlight and focus and give information to parents about the kinds of tools and controls that Apple has in macOS and iOS for helping protect their kids and protect safety and privacy of their kids and iTunes purchases and all that sort of stuff. Basically, the stuff that Apple has built into the operating systems for parental controls. And it was interesting because in the same week that this came out, and I don't know if it's because it came out you had questions or because, you know, or it was just coincidence, but I also this week got a number of questions from people asking about parental controls and strategies for parental controls and what you can do on Mac and iOS devices to kind of help lock them down to protect kids. And I thought that would be a good conversation for us to have here on the MacCast, because I have kids and I've probably never really talked about the kinds of strategies that I employed for my kids and my family. And of course, I'm going to share what I did with you and my opinions and thoughts on it, but by no means are they the only thoughts and opinions on it. So what I'm trying to do here is maybe open up the conversation with you and say, hey, this is what I did. You can take my examples or not take my examples and integrate them into whatever strategies you might have for your own family. Or if you want, share what you've been doing and what your thoughts are. But first and foremost, I think an approach you need to take needs to have multiple strategies. There's not just one strategy that's going to work, and it's going to be very individualized and very specialized depending upon, you know, what your kids are like, what their propensities are, you know, how voracious they are about consuming information. Just like everybody's different. So you have to take individualized approaches. Even like within my own family, each one of my kids, I have to kind of tweak how we deal with this stuff, right? So you need to develop multiple strategies, and technology is certainly part of that. The built-in controls that are in iOS and macOS are part of that. Maybe some third-party software might be part of that strategy. But before any of that happens, in my opinion, before any of that happens, first and foremost, I think the biggest strategy is just surrounding communication and laying ground rules and sitting down with your kids and your family and talking about all of this stuff, having an age appropriate, and I want to stress that very much, you know, sort of an age appropriate, child appropriate conversation with your kids about what's expected and what they might encounter and those sorts of things. So that's what I did with my own kids. We talked about, you know, when it was appropriate, what sorts of things they might encounter and we were concerned about with their online safety and their technology safety, both in terms of, you know, how much they're using technology and what kinds of things they might be exposed to or encounter at any given moment. And that includes both apps and the web and social media and all that other stuff. And when I mention, I just want to clarify, when I mention like age appropriate conversations, again, this is another area where it's going to vary wildly from kid to kid, and you're going to have to use your own judgment and sort of how you do things in your own family to decide what's age appropriate and what kind of content and things are appropriate to talk about. But, you know, sit down with your kids and talk about, hey, these are the kinds of apps and activities and things that we think are appropriate for you to be doing. And these are the kinds of places and things where we don't want you going. And this is why we don't want you going there and exploring these sorts of things. And whether that's, you know, violence or adult content or whatever it might be, again, you're going to have to adapt that for your particular family. And so having that conversation, I think, was very important. The other thing that is very important, I think, as well, is not only saying, hey, these are the kinds of areas and things you might encounter that could be bad for you or could be dangerous, but talk about, you know, what happens when they end up in an area like that, or they get an app that's being overly aggressive in terms of its advertising toward them, or they encounter inappropriate content or content that makes them feel not safe or like something's wrong. How should they react? What should they do? Because I think that's one of the biggest problems, is kids will eventually wander into, or maybe through a friend that exposes them, or something will happen and they'll get into a piece of content or an area where you've said, this is inappropriate, I don't want you experiencing this. And they're suddenly, they're thrown in the middle of it, probably very much by accident most of the time, and they don't know how to react and they don't know what to do. So give them some tools, give them some ability, and say, here's what you need to do. Like with my own kids, I just said, hey, just, it's not a big deal. Come to us and we'll have a conversation about it. And we did warn them, you're probably going to wander into stuff that you didn't intend to. Think about even just doing something as simple as a Google search or a Google image search, even with Safe Search turned on, you come across content that may not be child appropriate, you know, or even sometimes adult appropriate, depending upon what you're doing. So, you know, help them out with that. You know, let them know it's okay, it's going to happen. Here's how we want you to deal with it, so they have those tools. And the same goes for things like, how do in-app purchases work, and how are apps and different companies trying to market to them, and how should they react to that? You know, here's manipulative marketing, and they're going to try and get you to click on that thing to buy more Smurf berries, and they're really going to be in your face about it, and here's how you can avoid that, and here's why we don't want you doing that, or, you know, if you're okay with it, why you're okay with it, and all those sorts of things. You know, maybe you take the approach where you set up an allowance, and you set up, you know, Apple has some technologies for that, doing iTunes allowances and balances so that they can spend their own money and manage that sort of stuff. And those sorts of things can be beneficial too, right? They can be great teaching experiences on how to manage money. You can go into conversations about how, in many ways, a lot of this stuff is like gambling, and you can talk about addictions and all these sorts of things. So use this stuff to actually educate and have conversations. And I think that's a really great place to go too. You know, I tried to approach it from a place of, you know, what if I didn't have things like parental controls at all? You know, how would I deal with this? And what things should I put in place? And that's where I kind of started my strategy, was like, if I had no parental controls or technology to help me with this, what would I do? And that's where I started. Again, I don't know if it's the right approach. It was the approach I took, and it seems to have worked pretty well. Another big thing that's come up in the media recently is screen time. You know, the fact that kids are in front of their smartphones and their iPads and things like that too much, and that companies like Apple need to take responsibility for that, and they need to protect kids from screen time and iPad addiction and iPhone addiction and stuff like that. You know, from my approach, I went the other way. I said, you know, this is something that's going to happen. When I grew up, it was my parents and people talking about kids spending too much time in front of the TV. So the screen has changed, but the underlying problem hasn't changed. And so I think with all of this stuff, without any parental controls or any technology access to kind of control these things, I think the first thing you do is you set up ground rules. You sit down You talk about all these things, and then you talk about, okay, now we've been through all this. Here's the rules. Here's how much screen time we expect you to have versus expectations for other sorts of activities like homework or family time or face-to-face time. You know, things like many families, and my family included, we don't allow devices at the table when we're having dinner. You know, we're going to have that as family time, and that's going to be a conversation, and it's not appropriate to bring those things to the table when we're eating. And, you know, that's, again, a family rule that we have set. Maybe you are perfectly fine with having devices at the table, and that's part of your family culture. That's totally fine. You know, these are rules that we set up. They're not, you know, set in stone or anything like that, and everybody has to adapt it. Some other kind of ground rules that we set up, we have rules that, you know, I need to know all account logins and passwords and device passwords for my kids' technology. They're not allowed to be locked, and I'm not allowed to be locked out of them. And we've been upfront that we're going to monitor their devices and their accounts from time to time. You know, not anything oppressive, but, you know, we want to go in and check and make sure that everything's safe and everything is okay. And that was set up front, and so nobody's upset about that, right? So those sorts of things, I think, are important. It was part of the deal. If you're going to have access to this technology, we're going to know what you're doing on your devices, and that's just how we want to have our rules set up. We talked about and set ground rules for allowing or not allowing access to certain kinds of social media, which social media we were going to allow access to and which ones we weren't, and more importantly, I think, why certain social media isn't allowed. And we talked about the dangers of social media and the potentials of online bullying, and how do you deal with that if you're encountering that, you know? So don't just talk about the dangers of that stuff, but help give kids scenarios and tools that they can use when, you know, they might encounter online bullying, or they might have a friend that's being bullied online, and what should they do, and how should they react, and how can they be sympathetic and help out, and all those sorts of things. And again, your rules and approaches might be very different than mine, and I think that's awesome, right? That's the way it needs to be. So start with that foundation before you get into any of the technology stuff. But, you know, because this is a technology podcast and it's important, and Apple has some great tools for this, I think we need to get into the actual parental controls and the kinds of things that you can do and the limits of possible access. Because that's where the questions started coming in, is I had a number of you say, well, you know, I don't really understand the parental controls. What can I do with it? And I have to tell you, you know, Apple has done a great job. The controls are pretty extensive. Are they perfect? Do they cover every scenario? Absolutely not, but they are in there. They're built into iOS. They're built into macOS. They're a little bit different on each platform, but overall, you can kind of do a lot of the same things in terms of like controlling and restricting accounts, restricting access to certain kinds of content, specifically movies and TV shows and stuff you'll find in the iTunes store, apps. You know, apps have ratings, and you can limit access to that. iBooks, you know, what kinds of content you can get there. You can block sort of sexually explicit material and all those sorts of things. So those are the kinds of controls that I set up for my kids after, again, talking to them about what I was going to do and the kinds of controls we were going to put in place. And we set that up. So for me, I set up restrictions on, you know, based on age appropriateness and age rating levels to what they can get to in iTunes, the App Store, and the iBooks store. I also went in and disallowed any kind of management of accounts, setting up additional accounts for social media, iCloud accounts, email addresses, iTunes. We set all that stuff up in advance with the accounts that they were supposed to have access to, and then locked it down so they couldn't add any more of those accounts. And that's something you can do with iOS that was awesome. As far as getting access to stuff that's on the web, when they were much younger, I did a whitelist approach with Safari and the browser, so only certain URLs they were allowed to go to. As they got older, we opened that up, and at this point, you know, my kids are a little bit older, they have full access, but again, before they were given that access, we sat down and we talked about some of the dangers, the kinds of sites that were appropriate to go to, and the kinds of sites that we didn't want them going to or wanted them to come and, you know, ask about before they started just surfing blindly across the web. And we talked about, hey, why that could be a dangerous or a bad thing if they were doing it, and why we were concerned about it. We talked about again, what happens when you accidentally encounter that bad stuff? You click a link and suddenly you start getting all kinds of really bad spam pop-ups. What are you supposed to do? How do you react? You know, and the answer was pretty much, okay, just walk away from the computer, come get us, you know, let us know what happened and we'll clean it up, we'll deal with it, and we'll have a conversation if, you know, something came up that we hadn't already talked about. We'll maybe at that point have, again, an age-appropriate discussion about that and those sorts of things. And that has worked out great for our family. We also use family sharing, something that has been really great for helping monitor purchases and things like that. My kids get allowances and they want to buy things from time to time, mostly books from the iBookstore and occasionally a movie or a TV show or something like that. And they're able to just request that and I get a notification on my device and I can approve it or not approve it. And that works out great for us. You know, again, there's many approaches you can take to that, but it's nice that Apple has those tools built in for you. Another technology we use that is mentioned in Apple's new website is the Find My Friends location stuff. So I had a conversation with my kids. Hey, we're going to be tracking your devices. You can have an iPhone, but you're going to have location services on and it's going to be tied to... Oh, and again, when I say location services, I mean the Find My Friends feature, and it's going to be limited to just me and my wife being able to see that. In general, we have location services turned off on their devices and blocked and things like that. And that is another parental control that you can use. So just so that they're not broadcasting their location on other social media and other areas where they're using their devices, right? We want to keep them that locked down and safe. But definitely, we use Find My Friends. We talked about the fact that we want to do location tracking and discussed how it's really a personal safety thing. You know, if something were to happen, we would be able to use that information and that we weren't going to use it as something to kind of invade their privacy and be checking up on them all the time. That wasn't the intent, at least not in my family. Again, some families might want that to be a thing, and that's totally fine too. But you know, I love the parental controls that are built into the Mac and iOS. I have used them on top of some of the other things that we've talked about, and that's the approach that I take to it. So I wanted to share that with you because I was getting a lot of questions about that this week, and I will have a link to that new website, apple.com/families. Check that out. If you're wondering about the technologies that you have available to you, the things that can help you with this and what Apple is doing in that arena, that website has a lot of good resources for you. It's a great place to start. Again, are all the controls perfect? No, I know there are some third-party apps out there. I haven't found the need, at least in my family, to use any of that stuff, so I don't have any recommendations in that arena. I know that one area of parental controls that's kind of on the Mac but is missing from iOS is the whole screen time thing. On the Mac, you can actually go into the parental controls and set access times for your kids. So you can allow them access to their computer account between certain hours and for certain lengths of time. So you can say, okay, you're going to have 2 hours a day of computer use. You can use it at these specific times, or you can use it anytime you want. But once you hit 2 hours, it automatically logs you out and you can't log in anymore. So there is those timed controls on the Mac. They don't have those for iOS, although Apple did announce that they're going to be adding more parental controls or expanding the parental controls inside iOS. And I fully expect that that sort of screen time management feature is going to be something that they're going to be adding. It'll be interesting to see how they end up implementing that on iOS, but I think it is coming. So that's kind of some of my thoughts on parental controls. If you want to share what you're doing with your family or tell us about how you kind of manage this stuff, I would love to hear about that. And I'm sure other members of the community would as well. So shoot your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. And sticking with the area of security and privacy a little bit, I ran across a great article this week over at 9to5Mac by Benjamin Mayo. He wrote up a great little PSA on why you probably don't want to use Apple's markup tool to cover up sensitive information in your images and PDFs and things like that before you send it out or post it online. So if you're trying to kind of redact or block information, there's a little thing you should know about with markup with respect to that and why it might not be as secure as you want. And just in case before we get into that, just in case you don't know what markup is, it's a feature in iOS and macOS. It's a kind of an extension. It's in a few key areas. You'll see it in Mail. You'll see it in Preview. I also think you can get to it from the Photos app also has it. And it's the ability to go in and add annotations and markup to your images and documents. So you can add things like overlay text and put little arrows or boxes around things. And you can mark something up and then you can send it to somebody or you can post it online. And there are a couple different ways you can access markup. It really kind of depends on the app. The most typical way you'll use it is you'll access it through the share menu, through the extensions. So when you go into share an image or photo, you'll see the little markup icon. It looks like a round circle with a little pen tip in it. If you're viewing a PDF in some apps, specifically in Preview, you might just see the PDF. You might just see the little pen, the little markup icon. Inside Photos, you'll find it when you're editing a photo under the More section, so the little circle with three dots. It's because it is a Photos extension. And then inside Mail, I think if you tap on an attachment or if you add an attachment to an email and you tap on it in the little pop-up menu that comes up, there is a markup option. And when you access markup, what you're going to get is you're going to get a whole series of tools, different drawing and editing tools. So there's like a pen tool, a pencil tool, a marker tool. You have various colors that you can choose. There's an eraser tool if you want to wipe out sections of a photo. And then there's a lasso tool for selecting and moving a different markup. So if you've drawn an arrow and you need to move it, or you've placed a bit of markup text and you want to move it, you can use the little lasso to draw a circle around it and then move it to another area. And then in addition to those tools, under the little plus icon, I think it's a plus icon on the iPhone. iPad might have access to the full tools, but there's a few other tools. There's a text tool. There's a signature tool that lets you actually insert a signature, say, onto a PDF or into an image. There's a magnifier option. So if you kind of want to blow up one section of a photo to give a little bit more detail, I use that one a lot when I'm sending people little screenshots and little how-tos and stuff like that. And then there's some basic shape tools. So you can draw boxes. You can do filled shapes of rectangles and circles, and there's also arrows if you want to kind of point things out. So all very cool stuff, but as Benjamin Mayo pointed out in his piece, it's definitely not a tool that is used to, or should be used to, securely cover up or remove text, because many folks are actually tempted to use the marker tool because it's a nice wide tool, and you could, you know, put black ink, and it's almost like drawing with a black felt marker over a bunch of text. And if you go over it a couple times, the first time you go over it, what you'll notice is the marker tool has a little bit of transparency to it. But if you go over black text a couple times, it does appear to get blacked out. But what was discovered by Benjamin and a few others was that the transparency of that can easily be knocked back using a simple photo editing tool like Photoshop, or even just the light controls inside Photos, and you can actually get the text to kind of show back up again. So it's definitely not a secure redacting tool, and a couple of people have been caught off guard by this with images that have been shared online on social media. So content came out that they didn't want to expose. So don't use it for that. There are a couple other tools in there that will actually cover up if you use the pen tool, but it's a much thinner line. It's hard to kind of scratch something out with the pen tool. But you could also use that filled shape tool. So if you want to do just a box, a filled box with black in it, that will be actually opaque and cover up the image. But you even need to be careful there because the metadata might still exist. So if you have a PDF that has OCR text data in it, it's certainly not going to remove that OCR data. And also with PDFs, if someone opens that file up later in a PDF editor that can actually edit things, they might actually be able to remove your big opaque black box as well. So I would say, just in general, don't use markup, the markup feature in iOS or macOS, as a redacting tool or a tool to kind of protect your privacy in your documents. If you want to do something like that, use some third-party tools. There's specific redacting tools out there. The one that I like and use all the time, especially for PDFs, is PDF Pen. I know that Smile is a MacCast sponsor. We'll just disclose that. But I mean, it's a great tool for doing that. It offers a redaction tool that specifically blocks things out and removes any underlying OCR data from your PDFs. So use a tool like that. If you're worried about security and privacy, don't use markup. And I thought that was a great PSA. I will link to the original 9to5 Mac piece by Benjamin Mayo in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. And you should, because it is a really great, really great piece and a really great read. And then finally in the show for this week, Rick wrote in and he asked me, when the Mac goes to sleep, or when a Mac goes to sleep using Energy Saver, what happens besides the display going to sleep and the hard disk going to sleep? So he was wondering, you know, what happens when my Mac goes into sleep mode? And I think, Rick, the probably most obvious thing that happens is when your Mac goes to sleep, right, it's on, but it's consuming less power. So just like Energy Saver says, it's all about saving power. It also has the advantage of being quicker to start up than it would if you actually shut it down fully, right? So again, kind of obvious, but you know, that's the basics of what's happening when your Mac is going to sleep. And of course, you know, you can go in and adjust various kinds of settings inside Energy Saver. But, you know, what do all of those things mean, right? You have a bunch of different settings and sliders and stuff you can tweak in there. But what are you doing? I think your question ultimately is, you know, what are you doing when you're changing those things in all the different sort of sleep modes that the Mac offers? What is going on under the hood? So I'm going to do my best to answer that question for you. The display sleep. So let's start kind of with the most basic and we'll go to what I would consider to be the most sort of deepest level of sleeping. So at a very basic level, you have display sleep. And if you've enabled display sleep on your Mac, the display stops the video signal or the video signal to the display actually gets stopped for any internal or external displays. So they're not going to display any video content. Now, if you have an Apple display, either a built-in display or an Apple branded display connected to your Mac, it also means that the backlight, the LCD backlight, is going to get turned off to save energy. Now, for example, I have an HP external display, and I actually have to turn, when my Mac goes to sleep, I unfortunately have to actually turn off the power button because the display will still kind of be on. It goes into its own screen saver kind of mode, but there's still something on the display, and you can still tell that the backlight on the LCD is on. If I had an Apple display and it went to display sleep, it would actually shut the power completely to that display as well to help save more energy. So that's display sleep. You asked about hard disk sleep. This is the put the hard disks to sleep when possible option inside Energy Saver. What that does is it powers down the hard drive motor for any traditional spinning hard drive when you aren't reading or writing files to that drive. And you can probably, if you have that enabled and you have external drives or even the internal drive, you'll hear it wind down. And sometimes there's even a little, you know, clink or chunk noise that you'll hear. The thing is now that more and more computers have solid state drives, SSD drives, or flash drives. This setting has no effect on those at all because they don't have any motors or moving parts. So that feature really is only for spinning traditional hard drives. And another thing you'll want to know about the powering down your hard disk thing is if you have apps or tasks that you run on your computer that need constant read-write access to the hard drives, so doing things like photo or video editing would be one of those tasks, you actually might want to leave this feature off, even if you have traditional spinning hard drives, because what you'll notice is when it's on, it can slow down your Mac. A lot of people will complain about, you know, beach balls. My Mac is constantly beach balling. A lot of times when that's happening, it's because the hard disk has gone to sleep, and you've now done a task where it needs to access the hard drive and it has to take a minute to spin that hard drive motor back up to get that platter spinning again before it can read the drive. And if the drive is constantly going to sleep and coming back from sleep, you're going to see that slowdown happen. So even though I have external spinning drives, I think in general in Energy Saver, I opt to not have that feature turned on. And it just seems to make my Mac run a little bit more smoothly. The downside, I'm trying to think if there is a downside, because spinning that motor up and down, you know, like turning the motor on and off too, I think is pretty hard on the hard disk. They're designed to handle that, but it always just feels like a bad thing to me, right? It's sort of like, you know, driving your car on the freeway versus driving it around town. Driving it around town is a much harder on the engine than driving it for long distances on the freeway. So I think just leave it spinning, let it go. It'll be fine. But that's just my personal thought on it. If people have counter opinions, let me know where I've gone wrong. But, you know, that's just the feeling I have about it. But that's what happens with hard disk sleep. Another option you'll find in Energy Saver is the wake for network access. This allows your Mac to automatically wake up when someone accesses one of the shared resources, something like shared printers. You know, so if you have that Mac set up to share a printer, or you're sharing your iTunes playlist through home sharing, that will allow a network signal to come in and wake up that Mac. Now, this was a feature that always confused me, because it hardly ever worked for me, or I thought it hardly ever worked, until I did a little research and found out that this applies to wired connections from other computers on your network, or in the case of wireless connections, it only works if you have a properly configured airport base station. So if you don't use an airport as your network router, this really isn't going to work for you. If you have an airport, then it will work with certain applications and things like that. And it also, again, doesn't work for every application. So, for example, like I have a remote access client, a remote screen sharing client, and I have a Mac Mini, and the Mac Mini goes to sleep, and then I can't get it to wake up, even though this feature was on. Well, it doesn't wake up because it only works in certain kinds of scenarios. So it's somewhat limited. And another thing about the wake for network access thing, and I think this seems to make sense if you think about it, but if you don't, you might not realize it. The feature can prevent a Mac from going to sleep if another machine is currently accessing some of its resources over the network, right? Because you have wake for network access. So if the network's going on and, you know, somebody's trying to share a printer or access file sharing or something over the network, it's not going to let your Mac go to sleep. And so I've had situations where people are like, the Mac never goes to sleep, and they realize they have some sort of task that's running across the network and accessing resources that are on that Mac, and that's why it's not going to sleep. So in some cases, you might want to actually turn this feature off. Let's talk about PowerNap. So, you know, in addition to display sleep, you have something called PowerNap. This allows your Mac to occasionally wake from sleep to perform certain tasks like checking for email or getting software updates in the background. And when PowerNap is turned on, what will happen is any displays or any other hardware that's not needed for whatever task is running, that will be left powered down, but you can still get email. So the reason you might want to use PowerNap is, for example, say you have your email client set to go out and check for a new email every 5 minutes or 15 minutes or something like that. This will allow that to happen even when your Mac is fully asleep. It can kind of wake up, go out, grab your emails, bring them in, and then put it back into low power mode. And the advantage of that is when you get back to your Mac, you wake it up and all your emails are there. The Mac doesn't have to wake up and then go out and run that task again, go out and get all your emails. You got to wait for the emails to download. So it can be an advantage if you have maybe a slower network connection, or you just don't want to wait for those sorts of things. So that's a handy little feature. Sticking with just the Energy Saver control panel, something else you might notice is that specific models of Macs have additional options, so that control panel can vary from Mac to Mac depending upon your model. Doing things like letting the amount of time before the display turns off, being able to adjust that, Some Macs allow you to do that, some don't. There's some Macs that will let you automatically start them back up after a power failure. And then, of course, if you have a notebook or a Mac that has both an integrated and a discrete processor, you'll see options for automatic graphics switching inside the Energy Saver control panel. So those are some of the features and settings that are in there. A couple of their sleep modes that you might want to know about. There is a mode called standby mode. This is something that is available on any Mac that boots from a solid state drive. They're going to have this mode, and it's going to be a little bit different how it works depending upon the age of your Mac. So if you have a 2013 or newer model, they will automatically enter this standby mode if they've been asleep for 3 hours or more. If you have an earlier version, earlier than 2013 Mac with an SSD drive as the boot drive, they're going to enter standby mode after an hour of sleep. So your Mac goes to sleep, an hour later it moves into standby mode, or 3 hours later it's going to move into standby mode. And what happens during standby mode is the session of what your Mac is currently running, all of that stuff is stored to the SSD drive, and then the power is turned off to some of the hardware systems like the RAM and the USB buses. And normally you wouldn't want that to happen because you shut power to the RAM and everything goes out of memory. But what it does right before doing that, when it goes into standby mode, is it basically copies all the contents of RAM onto your hard drive, and then when you wake it back up, it will come out of standby mode and put all that information back into RAM. And for you, it's just seamless. You wake up your Mac and all your applications and everything you were working on was already there. But what happened really in the background was everything was shut down to save energy. And as a matter of fact, it saves a lot of energy, because a notebook with a fully charged battery in standby mode can run for up to 30 days without having to be plugged into power. Again, it's just sipping power at that point, and when you wake it up, it'll bring everything back. So that's standby mode. And then there's also something similar called safe sleep. And if you've ever run your Mac to the point where it's warned you about, hey, you're getting low on battery, you know, 20%, 10%, if you've let it run all the way to the point where it shuts itself off, it will have entered safe sleep mode. And so this happens when the battery becomes completely depleted and you don't connect to power. It will go into safe sleep mode. And again, what that does is, before it runs out of battery, it copies all of the contents of your memory to your startup drive, and then it powers down the computer. And what this does is it allows you to, once you can get plugged back into power, it allows you to resume where you left off. You won't lose the contents and everything that you were working on that was sitting in memory that you hadn't saved to the hard drive yet. So overall, when you go into safe sleep mode, your Mac is going to appear to be off. It's not totally off. It's just in this very, very low power state. And when you reconnect to power and press the power button, it's going to bring it out of safe sleep mode. And an indicator that your Mac had went into safe sleep mode and is coming out of it, and you may have seen this on your Mac, is when you wake the computer from safe sleep, you're going to get a little progress indicator across the bottom of the screen. So you're going to see it loading the memory, the stored contents of memory from your hard drive, back into RAM. That's what's happening when you see that little progress bar. So it's copying everything back over there. So that's pretty much it, Rick. That is all of the various sleep modes and sort of how sleep works on your Mac. Probably a little more extensive than you thought it was going to be, right? It's not just a simple thing. There's a lot of technology going on behind the scenes to help you save energy on your Mac. It's actually kind of pretty cool to think that Apple has put this much thought and effort into Energy Saver and the different energy saving modes on the Mac. So thanks for your question. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You know, if you have a technical question too, just you need help with your Mac, I'm happy to try and help out with any issues or problems. You can send emails related to that as well. I'm looking for more feedback from you. So, you know, if you're... Don't be afraid. Don't hesitate to send in a comment or question. If you'd like to have an audio comment played on the air, send me an audio comment and you'll get to hear your voice on the MacCast. Some people really like that. Others don't. If you don't like that, shoot me an email. That's totally fine too. But I welcome your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, you can check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.